40 something grandchildren.
I would say, yep, I think the last time I counted, we were upwards, it was about 40.
Wow.
And yeah, and so it's definitely a lot. And I made a point to once I took on this role, to reach out to try to reach out to all of them at different points, just to say, hey, I'm your aunt, you know,
Yeah.
because it's not,
Yeah.
it's difficult keeping in touch when, you know, you have, you know, four or five nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, 40 is almost impossible. But, you know, what I do is very much geared at doing this for them, doing this for their children and their children's children, and making sure that they have pride in having this bloodline and being attached to it. And so I try to share my mind them that this is theirs, you know, because it took us a while to understand that the estate of Peter Tosh was ours. I didn't take over the estate until 2009, and my father passed away in 1987.
Right.
So, right now I work with Peter's oldest granddaughter, Akeda Tosh, and she's been a godsend, really, because I didn't necessarily ask for her help, but she stepped into a situation and then just never stepped out. And I'm blessed and glad to have her, because we definitely balance each other out wonderfully, and help really drive the goals forward. And she also is a face. She's always on Instagram Live and really helps with the merchandise and you know, her, she's we're
Merchandise.
doing this together. I love it. I've been meaning to comment on it the whole interview.
Yeah.
I love, like I'm gonna say, I love the jacket.
Yeah, she actually
I
looked
love
at
it.
it. She will, you know, we connected, she and I did, because she reached out to me,
Yeah.
wanting, and I her, I'm sure, as one of her passions is connecting with people that can tell their story about Peter. She does Tosh Tuesdays, and she had
Yep.
me on there. We played some music, we talked, and we've kept in touch, and she's definitely very active on Instagram,
Yes.
liking anything and everything with the Tosh name, and commenting, and keeping the spirit alive. Her father is Peter's brother.
No, her father, she's Peter's granddaughter.
Oh, so
So her
that's
father is, yeah,
a
is
son.
Steve, who yeah, Peter's
Okay.
son.
Okay. Nice. All right. And so there's 40 grandchildren. So what about the 10 kids? Let's start with the 10 kids. Where are all the kids at?
Most are in Jamaica. We have, I want to say, six in Jamaica. We have three, no, we have five in Jamaica. Four in the States, and
Okay.
then we have one in Belgium.
And Belgium, right? Yeah, Jawara told me about that. So,
Yeah.
and I know Dre has kind of stopped up to do music, but
Yeah.
he's another grandchild, correct? You're
Yes,
right. So
yes.
we have.
Dre is actually the son of Andrew,
Oh, okay.
and yeah, he's amazingly talented. And it
Yes.
was nice to see, you know, him have that divine ability, because it's something that, you know, people end up born with, you know.
Yeah, and obviously everybody knows Andrew. Is there anybody else in the family that's doing music?
Besides Tosh One, he actually has a daughter that there's a couple of daughters actually that are very talented, as well as Andrew has another daughter that's talented as well. And they are dabbling in it now, you know, but, and you can see, you know, they're playing instruments, piano, guitar, one is actually writing and composing music. And, but then says that she's like, you know, I don't know if I'll do it. And you're just like,
Yeah.
girl. But you see the gift, you know, you
Yeah.
see that it's something. So I'm like, I wasn't born with that. Whatever you got going on, I
Yeah.
don't
Yeah.
have that.
Yeah.
So, you know, in time, I think that they will find their path and connect to the music in a more way that they can showcase it.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Yeah, because I don't remember her name, but he was, when we were spending a lot of time together, he was very excited. One, at the time, was very much just getting into music, and he was very encouraging. And yeah, so there was one daughter that was, he was very excited about, that it started getting into music. And I guess that's the one that, because I think, like, in such a short period of time, I think she was the one that even started doing piano. And what was her name?
Yes.
What was her name?
Jazara, yeah.
Jazara.
Yes. Yeah, so it was piano, it was guitar. And then she kind of was just writing quietly and even wrote a song dedicated to her grandfather, which was pretty cool. Yeah. And just the way that she put music together, it was just at a professional level. You know, you're like, oh my goodness, this could be a song that, you know, as because her influence was pop music, but you can see the song, you know, playing on the top charts. And
right. That's now, you know, I never knew much about her. I'd only read and heard about her, but where is Marla Brown, his last significant other, in this picture at the time? Where is she involved, or where is she, and what is she doing these days? Are you guys even in contact?
No, we're not in contact. You know, she was, like you said, the last significant other at the time of his death.
Right.
And she is not a part of the estate, per se.
Okay.
But she does have a hand in the museum, as because, you know, my father lived with her at the time. Right. They lived together at the time, so there was a lot of things and artifacts that
Okay.
That she was able to kind of provide for the museum.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody else that, you know, in the family that is playing any other significant roles? You know, obviously we've talked about the music, but maybe on administrative level or contributing to the legacy, or is there anybody else out there significant in the family, or maybe an extended family member? You know what I mean? That's somebody that's like family that's involved with the situation?
It's as far as the family's involvement, it's really, you know, the 10 children through me and Akeda, you know.
Yeah.
And then we have, you know, the amazing support of Brian Latour, who kind of stepped in a few years after me taking over the estate and really has kind of turned things around, because it's, like I said, my family, we didn't grow up in the music industry, unlike the Marleys, who at least had, you know, a level of understanding of what's important with music business. We literally had to kind of learn through the School of Hard Knocks, which I'm sure they did as well. But without us having that musical background, it definitely become, you know, poses a more of a challenge. And so we just continue to learn. Brian Latour actually has been in the music industry for over, you know, I want to say, I feel like I've been saying 25 years for like 8 years now. So it has to be at least like 30 something years. You know, working with, he was more so in the rap industry and the hip hop back in, like, working with Nas, LL Cool J, you know, and some of the hip hop legends, which is really, really cool. And he understands that business has to be shrewd. You have to kind of be a bulldog. And he's been the one truly, like, demanding that we get what's ours. And so has been really a godsend to kind of join the team in supporting us on our journey.
Yeah, it seemed like Jawar would talk to him almost every day, you know? Because I know they had a lot of stuff going on, you know, trying to score some deals and contracts and, you know, and the music.
Exactly.
You know, so, yeah, you know, I mean, I spoke to Brian. I actually, from time to time, you know, I mean, Brian and I have probably talked just a couple times since he's passing, but, you know, we kind of somewhat still stayed in touch. So, yeah, I mean, you could definitely tell Brian was a diligent person and was was very goal-driven, you know what I mean? Which is great, you know what I mean?
Yes. He eats, he doesn't, I don't know. He eats, sleeps, and dreams about the Tosh legacy. And it's really, even with, you know, what had happened with my brother, you know, Brian has become like family, just because he doesn't just focus on, you know, just business, you know, right. And when you're dealing with managing an estate, you're dealing with a family. So anything that we're dealing with is like, all right, Brian, what are we doing here? You know what I mean? And so it's really great to have him.
Yeah. Yeah. He seems like a good guy. Is there any particular agendas you would like to address at the moment that are important to you and maybe parts of some of the entities of the Tosh family or Tosh Foundation, before we move into maybe the last part of the interview? Is there anything else that you would like to discuss or bring to light in any shape or form?
I would say that we are currently working on, you know, I talked about the multiple platforms, you know, really finding different ways in which we can, you know, carry on the legacy or share the legacy and the story. So we are working on, you know, a Broadway play. We're also working on a major motion film, as well as a series, a streaming series. And so still in some of the infancy stages of all of those things, because it can take some time to get all the pieces together, but it's definitely a major focus. I think that one of the things that allow for people to really learn and touch and kind of feel more connected with the legacy is being able to be educated about really who he was, because my father has such a unique story, you know, and is a very, very talented individual, but also and you know, throughout history, he's been conveyed and kind of placed in this box, but he was very multifaceted, and those that knew him closely knew how much of a, he was very peace-loving and giving, you know, and funny, you know, he, you know, his public persona when it came to standing up for justice was very serious, but he was, you know, also just a fun loving guy as well. And so telling his story about how talented he was teaching Bob Marley to play the guitar and really being a true composer of the music because of that talent is something that I feel is very important to kind of share with the world through audio visual.
Yeah, that is definitely very true and significant. I mean, there's, you know, maybe you can shed some light on, you know, there's so many Bob Marley and the Wailers songs that that Peter had a very big part in and wrote, and some of them were actually his songs, you know. Maybe you can shine some light on some of those songs just to let our people know that no, that wasn't Peter's or Bunny's, this was, I mean, Bob or Bunny's, this was a Peter Tosh song. Give us a couple examples.
Yeah, Get Up, Stand Up, you know, 400 Years, Burial, you know, there's a lot that he had his hand in. And then they were very much brothers. And so they often, even though people may assume that there was some discord in the separation, you know, they actually, you know, just went their own ways, really, just because of the way Chris Blackwell, you know, kind of stepped in and pulled Bob Marley to the front of the band and then changed the name to Bob Marley and the Wailers. They were always the Wailers.
Right.
And even as my father left the band, he was, you know, he was just like, I'm always a Wailer. Like, that was what they identified, and that was their brotherhood, you know. So it was really,
it even went to the extent that Peter and Bunny's albums were basically still Wailers. It was just, now it wasn't Bob Marley and the Wailers, it was basically Peter Tosh and the Wailers, but they just dropped the Wailers.
Right Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It wasn't like he went out and got a brand new band, you know, he was You know what I mean? It slowly evolved into that, but you know, it took time, and you know, obviously he had things he wanted to say and record, and you know, and that's where Legalize It came in. But you, I mean, you go look at the liner notes and the credits, they're all there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, a lot of people don't necessarily know that history and understand that they were all part of one foundation, you know, and that kind of carried on through their individual paths as well.
Now, is there anybody from those days that surfaces, whether it be through them reaching out to the foundation or maybe through some legality, they might pop up? Like, because one name that pops up, because, you know, I was introduced to your father through my uncle, okay? So my uncle was helping produce the album in Jamaica with Lee Jaffe and Carl Peterson as the engineer, okay? So Peter used to be around the house from time to time. My uncle also had an apartment in New York where we actually have a picture of Peter, you know, and my uncle was a promoter, and, you know, one of my first live concerts, I remember I running around the Gusman Center, downtown Miami, with Sly and Robbie on stage and Peter. And we were little kids. We didn't know what was going on, but no, I mean, we loved the music, don't get us wrong, but you know, the music with kids only holds your attention for so long.
Exactly.
We wanted to play, you know. So one of the names, and I don't know if you ever read his book, but Lee Jaffe both basically wrote I guess it was somewhat of an autobiography, but there was a lot of stuff in there about Peter. I don't know if you ever read that book.
Lee Jaffe wrote an autobiography?
I think it was an autobiography or something. That's something that had, he sent the book to me because I had reached out to him, but I learned a lot of stuff that I've not really heard anywhere else. So I don't know the validity of everything in there.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it was obviously his story, his perspective, you know, but there was some big statements made in that, in that book, you know, in several different ways that I was kind of shocked. I mean, I learned stuff about my uncle I didn't know, and I lived with my uncle. Mm-hmm. But like I was a kid, you know, so I'm just wondering if there's like little stories like that that pop up from time to time that maybe you might like to share, you know, because that's just one that I know that you guys may not even know about. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, there's always lots of stories. Lee Jaffe definitely, you know, has his own experience, and me being the youngest, you know, I'm the youngest Tosh of the children.
Right.
So it's through these stories that I kind of get to kind of learn more about my dad, and then everybody's story, you know, is their story. Copeland Forbes is a great, has a lot, you know, a lot of experiences that he shared, and a great storyteller. Herbie Miller as well. And so I can't think of anyone right off the back, but I know that Lee talks about, you know, the Legalize It album and his role in that, and the creative way that was funded through, you know, with cannabis. And so, yeah. but the details of it, I wouldn't want to mess up the story because I don't know it as you know, to be able to retell it. I'm not there yet to be able to retell it just yet.
Definitely. Well, you know, to kind of wrap up the interview here for International Peter Tosh Day and celebrating 420 and the whole celebration around your father, I just had a couple of small questions to ask you about what happens to be your favorite song from your father.
Yeah, I definitely don't have a favorite, but I will say that there's a couple that that always come to mind when I'm asked that question. Because with my father's music, you know, some speak to you at different seasons, you know, in different chapters in your life, and you find yourself reaching for a particular song at different moments. But I would have to say Old Bumba Clod has to be one of my favorite songs, and, you know, particularly because of the way it starts. You know, it starts off saying that I came upon this land to guide and teach my fellow man. And, you know, I look at, you know, my father as a musical educator, and I was also in education. Although I taught math, it was really for the purpose of just being able to have an audience of children that I could, you know, sneak gems into, you know, watch documentaries and, you know, show them and talk to them about, you know, life in general. And so that song often resonates with me. Another one that resonates is Hammer, you know, Come Let Me Hammer Them Down, because in this business, you know, there's always a force, you know, that and in life there's always a force somewhere that can be trying to throw you off of your square, so to speak, you know, help, you know, have you lose balance. And sometimes you just need that hammer to just hammer them down, you know?
Me hammer, me hammer, make me hammer them down. Give me the rama, the rama, the rama, the rama, make me ram them.
Yeah, there's, I could probably, you know, take you on, you know, connecting different things, but those two definitely speak to me. Equal Rights and Justice, I would say, was one of my first favorites growing up. I remember playing that when I first had my sound. That was the song that I would just play over and over and over again. So.
But, you know, the song that changed my life was Legalize.
Legalize it. Don't criticize it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. And I will advertise.
Really wasn't aware what it was at the time, but it was you know, one of those. Is there, you know, you talk about the different seasons and the different moments that some songs, maybe you can talk through one of the songs for us, when you have a song in a particular situation that you like to play of your father's, if it's a particular time of year or a particular situation or a particular season that
Well, I would say that, I mean, Legalize It is something I play around this season, you know, International Peter Tosh Day, because, you know, and Bush Doctor.
Legalize marijuana. Down.
You know, because when you listen to those lyrics, you just is something that you really, really, truly can connect with, you know, throughout history. It has been, you know, Black and brown people that have been disenfranchised through drug prohibition, you know, and cannabis prohibition.
For sure.
And it's something that, even with my father's interviews, he was very intent on identifying and speaking out against and saying that, you know, all types of people smoke cannabis, but it's only a select group of people that are targeted, you know, and arrested and incarcerated for it. He said, you know, the rich don't go through what I go through, even if they're smoking cannabis. And he was aware of, you know, at the Montego Bay Jamaica World Music Festival, I think it was, he went into a speech talking about cannabis prohibition in America back in the 19, you know, so this 1914 business can't work. You know, he was very much aware of when there was a shift, because before that day, in that time, cannabis was legal, you know, and you could find all types of individuals using it. Doctors would prescribe it here in the United States, and it was, you know, all walks of life would use it. And then when it was used as a tool of racism, you know, that the Mexicans were coming into the country and starting, and they were consuming cannabis. And so, you know, the head of the drug, oh my goodness, Harry Anslinger was pretty much just changed the laws and really focused on targeting it at them, saying racist slurs, you know, that it's the Mexicans that are using it and using it as a tool to divide and conquer, saying things like, you know, when white women smoke weed, it makes them want to sleep with black men. And it was very, it was extremely racist. It wasn't like a little bit, yeah, right. Like a little bit racist. It was like 100% racist intention. Yeah. And that was really the fabric of our entire criminal justice system, you know, to really target black and brown people within this country. And then it ends up being something that happened around the globe.
Yeah, so, for sure. So you said that, you said something.
So So when I connect with, you know, and I always, it just makes me smile to know that he was just so ahead of his time and so enlightened, you know.
So that year you said what that was so significant was 1914?
That's what he says in the interview. Yeah. And so it's 1914, 19. There's a couple of significant dates around that time that you'll find the change, you know, that's when cannabis prohibition happened.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because I always hear about one thing that comes up from time to time was that they said George Washington's army wore hemp to fight the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? So, yeah. There was a point in time in America where it was illegal not to grow hemp because it was such a hot commodity. It could be used, it can be used for everything. You know, it can be used for food. It can be used for gasoline. It can be used, you know, to build. It's one of the toughest materials when you process it. They were using it on their sailing ships. They were using it for like canvas.
Yeah.
And literally, there's a book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and you can literally, there's so many uses for the book. And that book was found in my father's house when he passed away. So. Oh,
okay. what's up with the house in Jamaica? Does somebody live there?
My grandmother's, there's two houses, there's two properties. My grandmother's house, which is where we have family there, just upkeeping where the mausoleum is. And,
right.
And then we also have, my dad's house in the family house in Red Hills as well. And so.
Right. Okay. Well. So family's still at the Red, because I knew there was people in Belmont, Bluefields.
Yeah.
Somebody. Okay, good. That's good to know. You know, one little thing that I forgot that it kept coming up, but You know, I think it, you know, not that you need more projects or anything, you know.
Trust me, I haven't even touched, like I touched on some that are just present, but we have a wish list longer than you can imagine. Oh, so we're definitely planning on working on more.
Yeah, well, this is one that I've always thought about, because Peter really created his own language. you know, through the English language and the Jamaican, you know, dialect, you know, it, you know, there was one of my first books, introduced me to Rastafari, and there was a huge section on language, and it's very similar. It reminds me of your father's speech patterns. You know, it's not appreciate, it's appreciate love as just a very common, you know, but he kind of just took it a whole nother step further. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
it was, so I'm just, my point being is there, I think there would be great to have the language of Peter Tosh, you know, the handbook, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's actually a really great idea. Something I am aware of his language. He just had that gift to kind of, you know, create words like crime minister, you know.
Yeah. Or damagers instead of managers.
Exactly. And the shit stems. So you know, that would be something that's, you know, just a nice little coffee table book. That's a great idea.
Right. Like, you know, them combosos, you know.
Niambi,
thank you for your time. What a joy and what an honor. And you know, you could never tell that you're a quiet one from this interview. You're doing a great job, and I commend you, because you are basically the one that is keeping all of this not only alive but together. And I commend you. I mean, you know, I will always say, if there's ever anything I can do or we can do, I would be honored. And, you know, and I don't ever want anything for it. You know, I mean, I do the music for a living, and I'm just so blessed that I can do that. And I would do anything within my power that I can to give back, because for me, you know, by way of my uncle, my two biggest loves I got through him, and one of them was the love of reggae music, and the other one are these fine surfboards in my back. You know,
nice. That's
I always kind of try to incorporate those, because those are my loves, and I'm always trying to combine the two as well. So, if Lance, myself, my family, or my business Culture Shock can do anything for anything with the Tosh name, we are here for you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I definitely appreciate it. The love and respect is mutual. I definitely remember in my DJ days checking out some Culture Shock mixtapes, and so the connection's been there even before today. So thank you so much for having me. And I took surfing lessons once, and you'll have to teach me. And I was terrible at it. My daughter actually stayed on the surfboard at the age of three.
I mean, obviously Joara, we spent all that time when he would go with us to the beach, and I would go surfing, and he's like, oh man, I can do that. That looks so easy. And sure enough, he tried, but he did not succeed.
Not as easy as it looks. That's how, you know, we think that, you know, we have that spirit of our father. I'm the toughest, you know. I've tried the unicycle, and I've tried surfing, and it's something that I definitely have to practice in order to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was an all-star athlete in basically everything. And, you know, and Joar was saying he played football, and, you know, he played some soccer, football too, whatever way you want to call it. And he's like, oh yeah, that should be no problem. And, you know, I mean, he gave a valiant effort, but yeah, I think that was his first and last time.
Yeah.
So, you know, with all due respect, much love to you, to your family, and please give my regards to your mother. We will be in touch, and just always spreading the love of Tosh.
Thank you. And I'll just close by saying, if anybody wants to just learn more, definitely check out the website, www.petertosh.com, the foundation, petertoshfoundation.org, and then, you know, at Peter Tosh on Facebook, Instagram. And do use the hashtag for International Peter Tosh Day, which is Peter Tosh 420.